May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is James Harker, Cohen, Siglius, Paulus, Greenhill, and Furman, and we represent the appellants in this transaction. Mr. George Paulus has been admitted to the court pro hac vice, and I would like to introduce him to the court now.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is George Paulus, and I am counsel for the appellants, Berlin Steel Construction Company and Western Surety Company. For purposes of this oral argument, I would like to focus my comments on two points in our brief, specifically the seminal issue, which is whether S&B is a proper claimant under the payment bond, and the second point is to the extent that the court affirms the trial court's decision, we would ask that the court reverse the trial court with respect to structural services indemnity obligations to Berlin. The appellants will rely on their briefs for the balance of their arguments. In the construction industry, it's not uncommon for owners to request that a contractor provide bonding for a project. In fact, in the federal context, it's mandatory for owners to demand contractors to provide bonds. In all public construction, it's mandatory, statutorily mandated, that bonds be provided.
I assume when you say federal context, you mean a federal contract to build.
That is correct, Your Honor. With respect to the private contract, it's different. Owners may elect to require bonds to be posted, but it's not mandatory. There's no statutory requirement for bonds. So when the owner in a private project requests a contractor to post a bond, they typically will require a performance bond and a payment bond. A performance bond obligation is much different than a payment bond. The performance bond obligation is such that the surety promises the owner that in the event the contractor does not perform, the surety will come in, take over the project, and complete the project for the owner. On a payment bond claim, the promise is different. The promise is to the owner that if the contractor does not pay certain parties for labor material on the project, the surety, provided certain conditions are met that are privately negotiated, will step up and make payment to those vendors. In this case, we have a private contract. It's a private project. And the bond in question dictates the surety's obligations to potential claimants. In this case, the seminal issue at the trial level was whether S&P was a proper claimant under the bond. If they were a proper claimant, then they would have rights against for payment against Western. If they are not a proper claimant, they have no right. In order to properly answer the question whether they are a claimant under the bond, logic dictates that you must first look to the bond. And the bond specifically defines claimant to include two classes of vendors. One, those who are in direct contract with the principal of the bond. In this case, that was Berlin Steel. And the second category is those who are in direct contract relation with a subcontractor of Berlin. They're the only two categories of claimants that
in
Western...
In this case, that would have been structural.
That would be structural. So it's only those two categories of claimants that the surety was bound or guaranteed payment. Well, the trial court concluded that, and properly so, that S&P did not fit in the first category, meaning a direct subcontract of Berlin. The only subcontract, as the court pointed out, is structural. So the query and focus is only on the second category of claimant.
Well, when you say the only subcontract was structural, there were many subcontracts, weren't there?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that Berlin subcontracted for purposes of this matter with structural solely. There may be other subcontracts that the general contractor may have had other than Berlin, and I suppose there were. They were building a condominium tower, so that GBC, the general contractor, probably entered into multiple subcontracts on this project.
And did all those subcontracts incorporate the contract with the owner?
I don't know whether all of them did, but I know that Berlin's contract with GBC incorporated their contract with the owner. So, with respect to, in this case, structural is the only subcontractor that is in the line of tiers between S&P and the Berlin. The tiering is Berlin had a contract with Structural, who had a contract with J&J, who had a contract with S&P. So the question is, does S&P fall into the second category of claimant defined by the bond?
Well, going back to your overview of the difference between a payment bond and a performance bond, we know that the owner is interested in the performance bond, but it's the contractors and subcontractors that would be interested in the payment bond. Is that right?
That's right, in part. The owner is also interested in the payment bond as well because they want to ensure that payments made to subcontractors and suppliers so they do not lien, file a lien on their project. So the owner has a dual interest.
The owner is interested, but you know, if we assume that I'm a subcontractor, and before I embark on doing whatever I'm going to do, I want to know if I'm going to be paid. In this particular case, Structural could have looked at Berlin's bond and satisfied itself that it was going to be paid.
Absolutely.
And similarly, J&J, who was going to deal with Structural, could have looked at Berlin's bond and be satisfied that it was going to be paid.
That's correct.
And you're saying is if S&P had made the same inquiry, S&P would have found out it wasn't covered by the bond.
That is correct, because they're a tier too far down the chain to be in the class of claimants protected by that bond.
And so in theory, then, we have a situation where if people are interested in seeing whether or not their payments are secure, they should ask about the bond, read the bond, and find out whether they're covered before they start.
Absolutely. And that context of cutting off rights and the lower you go in the tier is within our statutory framework. Parties who can file liens, construction liens, are limited to the subcontractor and the sub-subcontractor by statute. In federal construction projects, you're limited to make claims under the Miller Act, but for the subs and sub-subcontractors. So this concept of cutting it off is very clear in our statutory framework.
As I understand your brief, the Superior Court relied on a Third Circuit case.
Yes, the NEC case.
And you're saying that NEC is distinguishable because NEC basically would have recognized a claim by J&J or JJ. And this is really distinguishable because we're one step below that.
Yes, Your Honor. I will also say that I think NEC also supports the conclusion that S&P is not a proper claimant. In the NEC case, the language of the bond was strikingly similar to the language of the bond we have in this case. The claimants that were protected were direct subcontractors as well as contractors who had direct contracts with subcontractors, just like we have here. NEC was in that second category, squarely fit into that second category. The defense that the surety made in that case was, if the principal of the bond, in that case Sardoni, made all the payments, just like Berlin did in this case, and therefore has no obligation to pay any lower-tier contractor, then how can the surety, who steps in the shoes of the principal, be liable for that debt? And the NEC court said that the surety's obligation to the claimant is an independent obligation depending on the language of that bond. And that language of the bond made very clear who was responsible, who was a proper claimant. It did not expand the liability of the surety beyond that which was set forth in the bond. In the trial court, the court looked at the word subcontractor and tried to explode the definition very broadly. They first said that the term subcontractor was not a defined term. The payment bond, in fact, incorporates the contract between Berlin and GBC, the general contractor, by reference. And in that contract, the term trade subcontractor and trade sub-subcontractor is set forth in Article 19. And it defines a subcontractor as one having a direct contract with Berlin and a trade sub-subcontractor as those entities will have contracts, direct or indirect, with a subcontractor of Berlin.
Is that an argument that appears in your brief?
Your Honor, it does not appear in the brief. The contract in place is attached to the payment bond. It's part of the record, but it is not contained in the brief, Your Honor. The court then goes on to say, well, if it's not a defined term, they expanded the definition to include all subcontractors, no matter what tier they're in, under the theory of a third-party beneficiary status. And they rely exclusively on Royal Indemnity for that proposition. Well, the Royal Indemnity case is much different than we have here. In the Royal Indemnity case, there was what they call a contract bond. This was 40-some years ago, 45 years ago. And in that case, the bond was one instrument in which the surety took on the obligation to the owner that it would do and perform any obligation that the principal had under its contract with the owner. And one of the contract terms was that the principal had to pay for labor, material, and the job. Berger, which was a subcontractor to the general contractor in that case, they made a claim. The surety took the position that, wait a second, this document is purely an indemnity obligation to the owner only for performance. I did not promise any payment or guarantee any debt to any third parties. The court then looked at the language of the bond itself to determine what was the intent of the parties, to determine whether there was third-party beneficiary status conferred on anyone. And when they looked at that language, it was clear that the contract bond incorporated the prime contract, which had the general contractor's obligation to pay for labor material. And therefore, the court, referring to the restatement of security, concluded that they were a third-party beneficiary and a proper claimant. But when reciting the restatement of security, that language that the court relied upon makes it very clear that in order to have third-party beneficiary status, there has to be an express intent for that, and if there's a disclaimer of liability, that would be evident that there is, in fact, not third-party beneficiary status being conferred. In this case, it's exactly what the Western did. What Western did was they wanted to make it clear that their guarantee was limited to certain classes, and therefore they specifically limited the language to first-tier subcontractors, only structural, and any contractor who had a direct contract with them.
So when you're talking about intent of the parties, the way I read your brief is Western wanted to know what it was insuring for, among other reasons, to calculate its risk and to calculate its premium. And in this case, it was insuring payments by Structural and JJ and Berlin. And what we see in this case is Berlin paid Structural in full, Structural paid JJ in full. So Western said, we have no obligation to anyone.
They said they have no obligation to anyone, to S&P in particular, because S&P was a claimant outside the classes that were defined by the bond.
Right. And maybe I should have phrased it differently, but basically, non-payment by Berlin would have been covered, non-payment by Structural would have been covered. And in this particular case, Berlin and Structural each made full payment.
They have.
So to the extent someone further down the line did not get paid, they weren't covered by the bond.
They were not covered by any claimant, any vendor below that second tier was not a claimant, could not possibly file a claim against that bond.
Well,
so Western would not have an obligation to them.
Your position, I think, relies critically on the proposition that the language used in the second clause of the definition is clear and unambiguous. To the extent that it is ambiguous, you have a problem, don't you? That is to say, if it is ambiguous, then, assuming that S&P had hypothetically come in and gotten a copy of the bond and looked at it, they could have concluded from the ambiguous language that they were covered, or at least arguably covered.
I don't accept the proposition that it's ambiguous, because the language says very clearly, just like the NEC court said, the same language in which and the NEC court expressed the opinion that language was clear as possible in defining who the claimants were. And that's the language of the NEC court. And in that court, in that case and in our case, that second category of claimant is defined clearly as one having a direct contractual relationship, direct, the term, direct contractual relationship with a subcontractor of the principal. So if
but that still could be read broadly. I mean, you're relying, I think, on an understanding within the trade. Is that correct?
I'm relying on two things, Your Honor, if I may. One, the language that's contained in the primary contract defining trade subcontractor that I
mentioned
earlier.
The language is in the primary contract, which you never argued in your brief.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But somehow S&P was supposed to have known that?
I understand the dilemma that I find myself in.
Okay. What else do you rely on?
I also rely on the express language in the bond, which lays out the phrase direct and also lays out the phrase of the principal. So if you were to interpret the second category to include any and all subcontractors on the project, then you would have to then conclude that the term direct has no meaning, and you'd have to conclude the phrase of the principal has no meaning. And I would submit that in appropriate contract construction, you have to give meaning to those terms.
And this is something that non-lawyer S&P should have been able to determine clearly,
Your Honor,
from the language.
From the language, I would submit that that any party can read the language and interpret the terms direct contractual relationship with a subcontractor of Berlin to be non-ambiguous and not subject to multiple interpretations without deleting words from that phrase. And with respect to S&P, a non-lawyer, in this industry, as in all commercial industries, we're not bound by the principle that you have to be an attorney to read and sign a contract. If they were concerned about their rights, S&P had certainly an opportunity to review the bond with their counsel and to be educated on their rights or non-rights. And with respect to S&P on this particular project, this was a private project. They had no lien rights, and they knew that walking in, and because of their station in the project being so far down. And it would not, I don't think it's a stretch to conclude that they would also recognize they had no bond rights if they had read the bond with counsel if they needed it.
Now, in Royal, this court cited the restatement, Section 165, security, which has the last phrase, unless the surety's contract in terms disclaims liability to such person, referring to labor and material. Now, does that require express language that there be a disclaimer, the word disclaimer, or
I don't think
a definition sufficient?
You know, I don't believe that this court, when they were talking about disclaiming liability, required a specific bold, highlighted section labeled disclaimer like you would think in terms of a warranty. I think in this case, Western did exactly what the Royal Court requested, which was define specifically who are you guaranteeing, that what obligation are you guaranteeing. So what Western did, consistent with what the Royal Court wanted, was add language in their bond to say specifically, I am only guaranteeing the obligations of the principal and the subcontractor to two separate classes of parties. So I do not believe that, reciting to this restatement, that it would be interpreted to mean that a disclaimer in the context of a warranty disclaimer would be necessary. I think you achieve the same purpose by specifically identifying which classes of parties you're going to guarantee. If I may move on just for a moment to the, I'm looking at my time, with respect to the indemnity obligation.
Just one last question.
Yes,
is it your position that the Superior Court read Connect too broadly?
Yes.
Okay, and specifically in what way?
They cite to Connect for the proposition that any subcontractor is permitted to make a claim.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the Connect case clearly, since it has the same exact language as we have in our case, the Connect case does not stand for that proposition whatsoever. It stands for the proposition that the surety has an independent obligation to those who are proper claimants under the bond. Connect happened to be one. If the Connect case dealt with Connect's subcontractor as the plaintiff, the next tier, that case would be on all fours as we have today.
But didn't the Third Circuit case connect also hold that, I mean, to the extent that there's any ambiguity, that's the drafter's problem, and the, you know, that it would be the obligation would be to disclaim liability to whatever categories were not intended to be included.
The notion that ambiguities are construed against a drafter is well settled in our law.
That wasn't my question.
I do not believe the Connect Court went so far as to conclude that the drafter would be responsible for that ambiguity.
The Superior Court, as I read the opinion, understood the Connect decision as requiring a disclaimer if the drafter wanted to protect itself. Is that an overbroad reading or is that an accurate reading?
I think it's an overbroad reading, Your Honor. In the next minute and a half, if I may, discuss a couple points with respect to the indemnity obligation. If this court were to conclude and to affirm the lower court's decision, then we believe that Structural has an affirmative obligation to indemnify Berlin for any losses suffered as a result of that finding. That the basis of that is contained squarely in the language of the change order that was signed by Structural and Berlin. That language in the change order says specifically that Structural is going to indemnify and hold harmless Berlin for any debts, and it goes on, of certain creditors identified as J&J Rigging, as well as Tom Salehi and his related entities. The argument that Structural has made in that case with respect to denying that indemnity obligation essentially is that the indemnity was too ambiguous and that it didn't specifically identify Western, any debt that Berlin had to repay Western in the indemnity language. The change order itself is a modification to the Structural Berlin contract. So the extent that the indemnity language does not specifically reference the project, I believe it's irrelevant to the conclusion and the interpretation of that clause. Secondly, debts is a broad term. Structural agreed to indemnify and hold harmless Berlin for any debts. If Western must pay S&P, then it will have a debt to pay and be incurred in debt, and we believe that that language supports an indemnity against Structural. I would like to... Unless you have any questions, I will say, including my argument, and I have two and a half minutes left for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Daniel Walkett for Structural Services. Even though I'm sitting on the appellee's side, I want to just indicate to the Court that I agree with Mr. Pallas's argument with respect to the scope of the bond, and we indicated that in our brief. But I'd like to just touch briefly, because I just have a few minutes, touch briefly on the indemnity issue. As Judge Johnston found after trial, after listening to all of the witnesses, she found that the indemnity in change order number one did not include, because it didn't mention anything about Western, did not include any damages which might occur to Berlin because Western was found liable under the bond. It's clear in the lower court that Berlin cannot be found liable directly by S&P. That claim was abandoned and there was an agreement to that effect. So the only possible way for Berlin to be liable would be through an indemnity agreement that they may have with Western to cover any of Western's liability in this case. During the...
Is that in the bond itself?
No, the indemnity is not in the bond. The indemnity I believe it was an exhibit below, but it's a separate agreement that Berlin has with Western with respect to, I believe, all of the bonds that... that Berlin and Western may have issued on behalf of Berlin. But during the negotiation of change order number one, which came about towards the end of the project. The structural services project was only about 3 or 4 months long, and they incurred lots of problems from day one, according to Mr. Benzing. And they negotiated an additional payment to structural from Berlin. And during that negotiation, during the times that they met, the evidence below indicates that there was no discussion of the bond, there was no discussion of Western, there was no discussion of the indemnity. And it wasn't until after the amount had been agreed to that Mr. Hunt called Mr. Benzing and said that, you know, you need to sign this change order and there's going to be an indemnity for anything arising out of what S&P might claim against Berlin, because at that time it was known that S&P hadn't been paid, and that they had written a letter and they were making noises about not getting paid, and so there still was no discussion about the bond or Western. Mr. Benzing testified that he didn't know there was a bond. He didn't know that Western had issued a bond. In fact, he doesn't know much about bonds at all because he doesn't get them. As a subcontractor, he's not required to obtain a bond, and he doesn't know a whole lot about them. The court found that because of the language of the in change order number one, that it didn't include any indirect, if you will, damages that would come through Western, and I would urge the court to affirm that finding. The one other issue I'd like to just mention briefly is one that the court did not speak to in the opinion, and that is if the case is remanded for some additional findings and S&P, or I'm sorry, structural might be found to be responsible. An additional issue is the mitigation of damages that S&P was required to follow. And that, while the court below discussed the notice to Western and said that was fine, it might have been, you know, after the fact, but it wasn't too late and nobody was prejudiced. The argument that Structural made was that S&P should have notified the parties that they hadn't been paid earlier so that there could have been some remedial action taken. And that remedial action obviously would have been that Structural Services would not have paid J&J if S&P was not getting paid. Very early on in this project, S&P was not paid. They knew they weren't being paid by July of that summer because the first invoice was due in 30 days and it wasn't paid. Then they didn't get paid in August, and they didn't get paid in September. And if they had contacted, and there was some ambiguous testimony, I suppose, and the court didn't find one way or the other about whether contacts were made to anybody on the site, but we would suggest that no contact was made until the fall of that year, really it was 2006. And that by that time, J&J had been paid, and there was no ability for Structural Services to withhold the payment. And so if the case is remanded for further proceedings, we would ask that the court direct the Superior Court to make some findings with respect to that particular mitigation damage, if you will, or argument. That's my argument. I see I have some more time, and I'll just reserve that for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Weidinger on behalf of Appley, Sala, and Pecky. I will address the arguments in the following order, whether we're a claimant under the bond, and then the arguments made by Mr. Wolcott with respect to the mitigation of damages. Those are the issues on the table vis-a-vis my client. I think that the the question really is the bond ambiguous? Because if the bond is ambiguous with respect to who constitutes a subcontractor and who constitutes a valid claimant under the bond, I think this court's holding in Royal governs, which is that people who provide material and work to a job are entitled as third-party beneficiaries to make a claim under the bond in the absence of clear, limiting disclaimer language in the bond. And it's our contention, and I think the court below properly found, that this was sufficiently ambiguous with respect to the meaning that it could and did cover subcontractors down the line beneath the level of structural. So what's occurring is...
Did the Superior Court actually make a finding that the definition was claimant was ambiguous?
Well, the finding was that it covered, in fact, all subcontractors. And so my contention is that in light of that, I mean, that's a clear finding of the court that subcontractors reached everybody in the absence of a clear definition and in an absence of a disclaimer.
So when you say a finding, you mean a conclusion, of law.
Correct. Okay. A conclusion of law.
How is that finding, conclusion of law, consistent with reading the word direct in the contract?
Well, I think that the direct contract portion relates to the role of a person who has a direct contract with Berlin. And a subcontractor, as we have, is doing work that would be the responsibility of Berlin. Berlin made a choice to then begin the process of continuing to subcontract this down the line without limiting it in any way. So we're doing the work that is otherwise required.
Mr. Weininger, I'm confused. Did the court, in your view, did the court determine that the definition, the contractual definition of claimant was ambiguous or not?
No, the court below found that we fell within the language. That's what I the holding.
I'm sorry, found what?
We fell within the language of
so
the
it was
claimant.
Not ambiguous?
Correct.
That the language clearly encompassed your client and would encompass unless there was a specific disclaimer.
That's correct. And the other side has argued, no, it's clear that we're excluded.
So nobody's arguing that it's ambiguous.
And well, what I'm saying is if there is an ambiguity, if the court finds that there's an ambiguity, then we win.
Well, help me just understand who interacted with who. You're representing S&P. You dealt directly with JJ. Did you deal directly with anyone else?
We dealt directly. The record is our contract is with J&J, and the only instances in dealing direct with other parties were the efforts beginning in July and then August to collect up the line. So,
right. So
our client
at the time
made
you didn't
efforts.
Get paid. That's what this case is all about. But all of your clients' dealings were directly with J&J.
My client's contract is solely with J&J, correct?
Right. So that was their direct dealing. And as I understand it, J&J dealt directly with structural.
J&J's contract runs to structural, correct, Your Honor.
And structural dealt directly with Berlin.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And as I understood your answer before, somehow we can get S&P into a direct relationship with Berlin. Is that correct?
Well, I think you can get S&P into a direct relationship with Berlin because we are performing services under Berlin's contract. We do not have
with two people in the middle.
With two people in the middle. That's correct.
Okay. But well, that's what I thought your argument was.
But that bond was clearly intended to cover the entire job. I mean, it's a $4 million bond for all of the work to be performed.
just so I understand it, your position is that the contract by its own language clearly covers all tiers of subcontractors.
Correct.
Absent a disclaimer.
Correct. As
the other side's argument is that the contract clearly excludes all tiers of subcontractors below the subcontractor that has a direct relationship with the general. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So nobody's arguing ambiguity here.
Well, what I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is if the courts find that there is ambiguity there.
Well, if anybody finds it, I guess we would have to do it without the aid of either side.
Well, this is a de novo review. The court is going to review the language of the agreement, and if it reviews that language and independently determines that it believes there's an ambiguity in that language, my suggestion is that we win in that circumstance. And the reason we win in that circumstance is the ruling in the Royal case, which is that essentially this is construed against the drafter. I mean, this is a surety bond. The surety insures these risks. And if it didn't clearly exclude that risk, somebody who made a performed work on the job, which we undeniably did, and we didn't get paid, should be able to claim against that bond.
Okay, but that argument, the one you just articulated, would be an alternative holding in support of the result, but not the ruling of the lower court.
Correct.
Can I interrupt you here? Because I've got two concerns. One, do you agree that your client knew that it could not put a lien on the property because of its level and the tier that it was in?
I don't think it's a level tier. I agree that my client did not seek and could not put a lien on the project pursuant to the lien statutes.
Okay, but you're saying that has nothing to do, that's not because your client was a subcontractor?
No, Your Honor. I think the issue is that my client, that lessors of equipment under that statute have been construed as not being able to make mechanics liens claims.
Okay, so moving away from the mechanics lien issue, am I correct in understanding you to be saying that it's clear and unambiguous that your client is covered because the only way your client would not be covered would be if the bond expressly said subcontractors below this level are not covered?
That's correct.
And that's what you're relying on. You're not saying that the language itself says subcontractors are covered. You're saying that the language says what it does, which doesn't address subcontractors, but that the law says if it doesn't disclaim it, you're in.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that this ambiguity here should be, and that this should be construed against the drafter. I mean, they're arguing this is a clear, unambiguous contract in their favor, and that anybody who looks at this bond page knows whether they are or they're not in.
And you're saying it's clear also, but you're saying it's clear because we didn't see any language that said we're out, therefore it is clear that we're in.
Correct. Unless the court has any other questions, I will move to Mr. Wolcott's argument with respect to mitigation of damages. I mean, it's interesting. My client left this crane on the job so that people could get the job done, and now is being argued that they didn't mitigate their own damages by pulling that crane off the job. I mean, essentially.
Wait a second. If I understood the argument correctly, it was not that you should have necessarily pulled the crane off the job, but that you should have let the potentially responsible parties know that your contractor wasn't paying you.
And we did that. I mean, the record is clear that at least as early as August that we made those responsible parties know it. Tom Salek testified to that effect. And the court found that there was no unreasonable delay on the part of my client in seeking to get paid. This issue was
when was the first time your client told Structural or Berlin that it wasn't being paid?
There's not an exact date in the record, Your Honor, but it is clear that it was run up the line above J&J in August sometime. That's the testimony of Mr. On direct of Mr. Sal. So the court below found that there was not any unreasonable delay and that there was no prejudice. Now, we're making a claim on the bond. The bond has some time limits in it. Nobody's arguing that we didn't make a claim timely under the bond. So it's hard to understand how they're arguing a prejudice when we are just simply making a claim on the bond and following it up in conformance with the time requirements set forth in that bond. Unless Your Honors have other questions, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My only point of rebuttal is that in the Connect case, the language that defined claimant was essentially the same as we have in this case. And in the Connect case, Third Circuit was charged with the responsibility of reviewing that language. And in that review, and in its opinion, the court stated that rather it is suing on the bond, which was an undertaking by Knoll, by United, and Sardoni, that without regard to the provision of later subcontracts, created an independent liability to claimants as defined in the bond and in the clearest language possible. Allow the claimants to sue on the bond. So Western and Berlin take the position that the language is clear, that there is no reason that a reasonable person could possibly interpret that language to include any parties other than those who had direct contracts with either the subcontractor Structural or with Berlin.
Now, in the Connect case, Connect had a contract with Ambrose, right?
Yes.
Which had the contract with Sordoni.
Correct.
Which had the contract with Knoll.
Correct.
So why aren't we exactly on all fours on the facts?
Because in the Connect case, Sordoni had the bond. They're in the same position as Berlin. They subcontracted to Ambrose, which is in the same position as Structural. Ambrose then subcontracted to Knoll or Connect. And Connect is in the same position as J&J. That's why they fall squarely in the language of that term claimant. If you know the first questions, I thank you.
Thank you.
Dispute about when S&P notified the parties, Structural or Berlin, with respect to not being paid, and the court never found one way or the other, didn't make any ruling on those particular conversations, whether they happened or not. Mr. Sala said that they happened in July. Mr. Benzing testified he didn't, no one talked to him until the fall, and Mr. Hunt indicated the same, and that no one talked to him about S&P not being paid until the fall.
Do you agree, Mr. Walkett, that the claim was made timely under the bond?
Yes, I do. I do agree with that.
Now, what relevance does that have to the mitigation argument?
Well, because S&P can only make a claim under the bond for what it's owed, and if it's not owed 100% of what it's claiming, then it can't make that claim. So just because someone makes a claim under the bond doesn't mean they get that amount. You still have to decide what amount they're due. And we would suggest that they're not due the full amount because there could have been some holdback of the amounts that were, okay, were owed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. According to my indiscernible chart here of time allotted, you have 3 minutes and 23 seconds if you want to use it.
Unless I
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.